Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show with Mark Walker on graduating from the rat race to multifamily investment deals. I'm Dan Breslin, your host of the REI Diamond Show. Today's guest, Mark Walker, has been buying, building, and holding residential real estate since 2004. Last year, he purchased and improved his largest deal to date, a 64-unit multifamily deal in Dallas, Texas. Mike and I are going to cover all the details on this deal, including how it was funded with a non-recourse loan. Had the renovation budget included in that original non-recourse loan? Even how Mike managed to beat his original rent expectations by 12%. That translates to a huge win, especially when it is multiplied across 64 units on one deal. And all of this was done within the first 12 months of ownership. So without further ado, let's jump right in. All right, welcome to the show, Mark.
Hey, I'm really thrilled to be here, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm happy to have you on the show. I'm excited for another great interview here. For the listeners who weren't paying attention, we got a little bit of a strategy and we talked about some pretty exciting things. Why don't we start off, Mark? I know you had kind of like 9-to-5 or full-time job lifestyle just from our previous conversations. So maybe you can talk about, you know, what that was, how you made the transition into, you know, quote unquote, escaping the rat race, which so many of us Robert Kiyosaki readers have aspired to and or achieved, especially those who have come on the show. So why don't you just give us a Reader's Digest version of how you got to where you're at today and what your business looks like currently.
Sure, absolutely. I actually read that book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki, and it was late 2003. That's really what kind of lit this fire, gave me the spark, you know, that wanted to go out and look more into real estate and really rekindle my desires to be an entrepreneur. At the time, I was working for a large, you know, Fortune 500 company. I did traditional marketing. I loved my job. I loved the people I worked with. It was fantastic. But in 2004, my wife and I bought our very first rental property. It was a duplex in South Denver. The cash-on-cash return on that first deal was 36.5% in the first year, which frankly, I'll admit, is just outstanding. Part of why a return like that was so high was because back then you could get interest-only loans. You know, on a rental property investment like that, you can't get those types of loans anymore, at least not that I'm aware of. You know, that certainly played a role. Plus, you know, we just bought smart as well. We found the right investment. Well, we owned that property for about a year or two, rented it out. We self-managed it. Because we figured, hey, you know, if we self-manage this, we'll learn some things along the way. You know, that'll help us in the future if we want to, you know, hire full-time management or professional management. It'll help us kind of interact with them and kind of have walked in their shoes. And Dan, you know what the number one thing that we learned during that process was?
Was that?
It was that we never want to property manage a property ever again. We definitely wanted to do professional management going forward. So that was definitely a key takeaway from that very first investment. But you know, I'll tell you that we ended up selling that property. Our original intent was a 1031 exchange into something else, but we ended up for various reasons sitting out the next few years. You know, that turned out to be a blessing in disguise as well, because we all know what happened with the subprime crisis. You know, we ended up missing, you know, the crash and all of that stuff. So it was in about 2010 then that we started networking again and getting plugged in. I met a developer and we ended up doing a couple deals together in a real trendy part of Denver. We ended up scraping a couple single family homes. What I mean by scraping is that we actually tore down a couple single family homes and we used those lots to erect a three-story duplex on each of the lots. You know, like I mentioned, this was a real trendy part of Denver. It was getting a lot of investment at the time. And those deals went fantastic. We ended up building those. It took anywhere from 12 to 15 months from start to finish to literally have sold those duplexes off. And we sold off each side of the duplex. And so when the money started coming out from those investments, I knew that I really wanted to start building passive income again, you know, and creating mailbox money or monthly cash flow. And so that's when I started taking those gains and investing it into rental properties. And that was from about 2011 until about 2014 is when I bought all of my stuff in the Denver, Colorado market. And towards the end of 2013, I bought my very first smaller apartment complex. It was 12 units in Denver. The intent with that one was to hold it for 10 years, you know, as that area just kind of continued to build itself out. But by the end of 2014, I was ready to leave the rat race or quit my corporate job. I had enough passive income where I could make that exit. And I'll tell you, you know, for me, Dan, it was kind of a decision that I accelerated a little bit too, because I was starting to get a little frustrated working in a corporate job. And that was largely because I would look at how quickly I could make decisions for my own business with the help of like my property manager or my lender or my insurance agent. You know, things like that. And I could see how quickly fruit would begin to, you know, bear as a result of those decisions. Well, you compare that to my corporate job, and it seemed like everyone in the company had the power to say no, but no one had the power to say yes. And so when I was comparing that large company experience to being an entrepreneur, that was something that was really frustrating for me. So I decided, you know, even though there was a time I was thinking, well, I'd like to probably go another 2 years, I decided, you know, I'm just too frustrated, and I decided to go ahead and exit the rat race. And that was January of 2015. So by that point, I had built a modest-sized residential portfolio in Denver, Colorado. That's when I started really getting serious about multifamily. I have a cousin that's a 30-year veteran in multifamily. And he said, well, you know, if you're going to, you know, leave your job, you're welcome to come sit in my office and job shadow, you know, and see how it's done, you know, how the big stuff goes down. And so I did that, and about 8 or 9 months went by, and I ended up putting a 64-unit apartment complex under contract and ended up closing that by the end of 2015. And then I spent a lot of last year renovating that property and repositioning it and raising the rents, doing things that could actually decrease the expenses, the operating expenses. And that's been an outstanding investment. And so that was kind of my launch into multifamily real estate right there. So my journey's been one of, you know, after I got the spark from reading that book, I just gradually started doing smaller deals, just like playing the game cash flow. And then gradually just started doing larger and larger deals. And that's what's brought me to where I'm at today.
Nice. So currently in your business, like what has happened maybe in the last like 2 or 3 months? What's your time like? What kind of deals are you putting together? What kind of like challenges are you facing just recently since, you know, I guess all of last year you did the 64 unit. I assume you didn't just sit back and stop, all right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've been looking for additional deals here and there. I do have a small equity stake. I'm not the lead on a 96 unit, but I did end up taking a small equity stake in a 96 unit deal. But as far as, you know, finding my next deal, you know, the market's gotten really heated up lately. You know, it's a lot more competitive. And one thing I've always done is I've always stuck to my acquisition criteria. I'm very fortunate in the sense that I don't have to have a deal. I guess I kind of take the Warren Buffett approach, right? Where, you know, I'm looking for opportunities that fit my acquisition criteria. And if I'm fortunate that I've built a passive income and rents have gone up significantly in the last 2 years as well in my portfolio in both Texas and Colorado. That 64 unit, by the way, is in Texas. So I don't have to have a deal. That's what's great. You know, the great part about it is that as I'm looking for a deal, I'm spending a tremendous amount of time with my daughter. She's 5. And my wife, we're a pretty close family, and I know this sounds awful, but, you know, I have enough passive income. I don't have to even get up in the morning if I don't want to, you know. Now, granted, I do, right? I am looking for that next deal, and when I find it, I'm going to do it. But it is very competitive out there right now, so I'm just waiting for the right deal to find the right deal.
And so the exit strategy with the 64 unit, is that going to be a long-term hold? Do you have a disposition date set up? You know, maybe we could pick apart some of the details of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I tend to be a long-term hold type of guy. But one thing I have considered doing with that property, even if I do decide to hold it, would be doing a supplemental loan. So on the 64-unit deal, I was able to get agency debt on it. And so agency debt is basically offered by the common lenders are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What's really attractive about these loans is that they're non-recourse loans. You know, you go to a bank, typically those are going to be full recourse or partial recourse loans. where if something goes wrong with the investment or with the property, then that lender can have recourse on you as the individual. They can, you know, come after you and your assets in order to make themselves whole. Well, with agency debt, you know, with the exception of what we call bad boy carve out, which might be like things like fraud or something like that. With that obviously being, you know, the exception, if anything goes wrong with the investment, there's no recourse on you. Now, getting those types of loans is very difficult. And so, you know, if you aspire to be a multifamily investor, then there's things that you are going to have to demonstrate to a lender in order to be eligible for that type of financing. So I was able to get agency debt on it, but with agency debt, you also have the option of doing what's called a supplemental loan. It's kind of like getting a second mortgage or a home equity line of credit is what I might compare it to, right? Where you're able to, rather than, you know, refinance the property, you're actually getting a second loan, you know, on it that is supplemental to your first loan, and you're able to get some of your cash out. So that's definitely an option. The property is now stabilized. I've demonstrated that, you know, rent, I've raised rents over the last year at that property, and I've demonstrated a new T12 financial statement. So I've demonstrated that there's, you know, what the new income and expenses of the property are. It would be relatively easy to go get a supplemental loan and take my initial cash investment out.
Mark, is this debt long-term, or is this a five-year refinance when you do this agency debt?
When you do agency debt, the typical terms is you can usually get a five-year term, a seven-year term, or a 10-year term. I've seen 12-year terms as well. I ended up doing a 10-year term. Now, the downside of agency debt, this is one of the things I talk about, that's actually, you know, you might get more favorable terms by getting recourse, you know, financing from like a local bank, but agency debt has pretty large prepay penalties. So if you want to pay off that loan early or refinance it within, you know, 10 years, then you're going to pay a really large prepay penalty. So that's why typically when you do a supplemental loan, you're actually not taking out that first loan or refinancing it. You're actually just adding a second loan or a second lien onto the property. But it is possible.
Large.
It varies, you know, but the best way I can describe it, you know, they call it yield maintenance. And the best way I can describe yield maintenance is that, you know, there's an investor that basically invests in your mortgage, right, that you're getting. That commercial loan is a liability to you, but that's an asset to somebody else, right? Somebody else has invested or put up the cash to fund that loan for you. When they do yield maintenance, that investor wants to get the same return that they would get in the 10-year term of that loan. So if you decide to, say, refinance the loan or pay them off in year two, you've basically got to, the prepay penalty is going to be the same amount that they would have made on that investment as if, you know, it carried out the full 10-year term. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah.
So let's say you were going to pay, say, 5% interest on a loan for 10 years, and then it termed out after 10 years. If you pay that loan off after 2 years, it doesn't matter. You're still on the hook to pay them the same return that they would have made for the additional 8 years, and that's what the prepay penalty would be.
I mean, in terms of a percentage of the loan, are we talking like 10, 15? What does it add up to? Because it's a little bit of a complex for me to do on a napkin, I think.
Yeah, like I said, yield maintenance is different than just like a flat prepay penalty, right? But I'd say, you know, yeah, it's not uncommon for this to be like 8, 10% if you were to pay off the loan in the earlier years. And obviously, too, with yield maintenance, you know, the going rate, you know, today's rate plays an impact as well, right? So if rates actually go down, you know, between when they gave you the loan and what it is today when you're looking to pay it off, then, you know, the yield maintenance actually, your prepay penalty is actually higher because, you know, they would have to reinvest their money in another loan and they're going to get a lower rate for that. So that's something that also gets factored into, you know, that prepay penalty as well. Yield maintenance is very, very complicated. And this is one of the things that, you know, like I said, I consider this one of the cons of doing non-recourse type financing. Agency debt is really a tool that you'd want to use once you have a property that, you know, you plan on holding for a while, or it is more of a long-term, you know, 5, 7, 10 year investment.
So you talked about buying smart, Mark, and you also mentioned Warren Buffett's name. And I wrote an article a few years back on the investment philosophy of real estate investors and knowing why you're buying a particular asset in a particular market And you had also mentioned some things, buying a couple properties in the right place and rents increasing and things of that nature. So do you have an investment philosophy that you follow, a set of written rules that you would share with the listeners?
Yeah, you know, my general acquisition criteria is something that I stick to pretty consistently. I typically look for C-class properties that are located in B-class areas. And just to describe, too, for those listeners that may not know, when I talk about A-class, B-class, or C-class properties, those are typical ratings that we give to property types, right? An A-class property, in the simplest terms, is going to be like your Ritz-Carlton, right? It's going to be your newest construction, brand new construction, you know, has all of the latest finishes. You know, B-class property is maybe like 10 to 20-year-old construction property. And then C-class is going to be below that. Typically, C-class properties are rents to people that, you know, are looking for a more value living situation. They don't consider their living or their apartment as a luxury, like, say, someone that's renting an A-class type apartment. So it's like a grading scale. Same thing goes for areas. You know, an A-class area is going to be, like, surrounded by, you know, really nice retail and a really nice area, whereas a C-class area is going to be an area that maybe hasn't had some investment in a while, you know, maybe has some older retailers and stuff like that operating in the area, or no retail at all. So I typically look for C-class properties, older vintage properties that are located in B-class areas. And then I do a very thorough underwriting of every single property before, you know, deciding whether or not to make an offer. And so that analysis, I model it on a 5-year hold, and I'd like to see a low to mid 20s IRR on that property. And I'd like it to be a double-digit cash-on-cash return by the second year after I've done any type of renovations or value add to the property. And I have tools that are developed around that. They're proprietary tools that I, just so everybody knows, I can't share them. They're proprietary tools that I use. I'm sure you have them as well, Dan, that you use to analyze deals. But I do stick to my acquisition criteria. And that's part of what's made it difficult to find that next deal, is I have a strict acquisition criteria. I know how I can unlock value on a property. I know I have a secret sauce, just like I'm sure you have a secret sauce, Dan. So, you know, it's just a matter of finding the right property that fits your value add component, or how you're going to unlock the value in that property.
Yeah, and what you're describing too, and what, you know, also would be waiting for the right investment. I mean, if you take Warren Buffett, he'll sit on the sidelines for a year, 2 years, long extended periods of time, and the markets get crazy. And quite frankly, we're sort of at the top of the market cycle now, but think, and we could maintain like a stable market, not necessarily, I think, like a calamity and a crash the way we had prior. Although that's not entirely ruled out, you know, market could definitely cool off, and it has in a lot of areas. I know that here in Chicago, where I'm sitting right now, Lincoln Park, I believe, is a $1.6 million average list price a year ago today. And I think it was like a 1.45 average list price now in today's current market. The article just came out this week. And that's an indication of, like, that's about a 10% or more decrease in value on the high end. And if you just think about it, it's a supply and demand issue. I mean, we're talking about prices that have gone up as a result of the supply being constricted as a result of coming out of a real estate crash when developers had lost funding and had to cold stop clean across the board. So we had like a nuclear winter, if you will, new construction, and then, you know, people going to rent. We saw the increases in the apartment complexes. So we're certainly at a time in the market where things are frothy. And, you know, it's a time of warning if people are going to say, well, maybe this is just a new environment. You know, Trump's in office and this is how things are going to roll. I can recall people saying that same type of rhetoric right there in 2005, 2006. Well, real estate always goes up, and we got these new financial instruments here. So these are just the new prices. This is how it is. And as soon as you get comfortable, that's kind of when the crash comes.
I completely agree with you, Dan, and that's one of the reasons, too, why I love what we call value-add deals. You know, deals that I can, you know, maybe have low rents or they've been operated poorly. And one thing it's really important, I really want to drive this point home, is that, you know, if you see a property, whether it be residential, multifamily, anything, and, you know, someone's telling you that, oh, well, this is the market, the rates are well below market, you know, you can acquire this property and raise the rents, realize that anytime that's the case, you're going to have to invest money in order to unlock that value. So I love value add deals. When I analyze deals, I look for deals that, you know, I can go in and I can invest capital to unlock the value of that property. And my objectives are really clear. I need to find ways to increase income and ways to decrease expenses. And, you know, I have to base that on what's the comparables that are around that property. If the properties next door are renting for $100 more and they're a similar vintage property, then I have to ask myself why. Do they have new appliances? Do they have, you know, renovated units? Did they upgrade the common areas? Did they add a playground or a dog park? And did they spruce up the landscaping? Things like that. If I can make my property like the property next door that's renting for $100 more, then I'll raise rents. So I build all of those assumptions into my analysis. Those are the types of deals that I love because I'm not counting on the market going up anymore. I'm just counting on the market, you know, essentially being stable and being able to raise rents as a result of improvements that I make as opposed to just the market going up organically.
Are there some key performance indicators that you look at as far as, you know, you see a B class or C class neighborhood, but what about the region in general, things like population growth and any other numbers that you would pay attention to and say, oh no, this is not an investment I would make because of the macroeconomics of that area or XYZ, or yes, this is an area I love because the macroeconomics are XYZ.
Yeah, definitely. I typically want to see, you hit on it, I want to see an area that has a growing population, not a declining population. I also want to look at the average incomes, the average and the median incomes. And one test that I run is I look at the rents that I'm expecting to get for that property. And I just run a really quick little calculation. I look at the average and the median incomes and I ask myself, is that median income, is that two or three times my desired rent? Because that's where you want to safely qualify a tenant to move into your property, is you want them to have 2.5 to 3 times income of what you're asking in rents. Otherwise, you know, they're not going to be able to afford the property. So I actually run that against what the average and the median income is for that area, just to make sure that I'm not way off in terms of what I'm assuming I can get after renovating a property. If I'm assuming that I'm going to get, you know, $100 increase in rent by renovating units, if the population doesn't have enough income to support the $100 increase, well, then I'm in trouble, you know. And that's where the comparables come in handy as well. I'll also go out and I'll actually visit the properties that are within a half mile or a mile radius of that one. And I'll look at what they've been renting for and what their occupancy is and stuff like that. And then, you know, I'll ask themselves, well, what is it about that property that they have or are doing that justifies that higher rent?
So you're literally mystery shopping those others as if you were a tenant going out and checking out the units that are available for rent?
Yeah, sometimes I mystery shop. And, you know, there's other times too, you know, I'll just go in and I'll say who I am. Hey, I'm Mark. I've got the property next door under contract, or I'm looking to buy it. And I'm just curious, you know, and it's just amazing too. So oftentimes the property managers, you know, they'll just open up to you. You know, I've walked into properties before and ended up spending 45 minutes to an hour sitting with the property manager. They'll take me around, show me their model units. They'll talk about, you know, their occupancy trends, and they'll talk. I mean, a lot of them just love to talk about their property and their achievements. And that's great.
So on that 64 unit that you did, Mark, can you give me an example of like a price per door projection, how you looked at the potential repairs to unlock the additional value, which you eventually did follow through, and then maybe give us a little bit of an insight on what those projections correct or what might have been the big surprises that popped up later after the fact?
Sure. My all-in price, and when I say all-in, that was the acquisition cost of the property plus my first year CapEx budget plus closing costs, put me in the high 40,000s per unit to acquire the 64 unit property. So I think it was something like maybe $47,000 or $48,000. I don't remember. At the time when I acquired the property, the rents were about 91 cents per square foot per month. And my goal in my underwriting was to get that to $1 per square foot on average by the end of the first year. So I acquired the property, immediately started renovating. You know, I ended up spending about $5,000 per unit on average to renovate the entire property. So, you know, I think about a third of that was set aside for interior unit renovations. The other two thirds was set aside for exterior improvements. So I did things to spruce up the landscaping. I added a picnic area, you know, did some pool repairs, bought some nicer pool furniture, made the exterior of the property look great, repainted the property, replaced the fence, did some really nice things to spruce it up. Then I renovated. My original plan was to renovate half of the units. And in doing that, I replaced all the flooring. I, you know, put in two-tone paint, replaced all the plumbing fixtures in the unit, all of the lighting fixtures, also put in new appliance packages in all of those units as well, resurfaced the countertops, the tubs, the sinks, all of that stuff. It really made the interiors look very, very, very nice and very clean, very new looking. And by the end of the first year, again, my goal was to be at a dollar. By the end of the first year, I was at $1.12 per square foot. So I beat the goal by about another 12%. And, you know, I also came in under budget on a number of, you know, renovation items. And so I was actually able to renovate in that first year instead of 50%. I probably ended up renovating closer to about 65 to 70% of the units. And so that worked out really well. Worked out really well and still, you know, hit all of the cash flow targets and all that stuff. It really has been a fantastic investment.
How often did you have to physically go to this deal to check on it? Because is this driving distance from you or flying distance?
It was in flying distance. So I live in Colorado. This one's in Dallas, Texas area. I would go down when I was renovating the property for the first 6 months or so. I'd go down once or twice a month. What was amazing about it too is the airfare was really cheap. Frontier Airlines has really low flights between Denver and Dallas. In fact, it's kind of funny. There were a couple of times I'd take a flight, I'd day trip it. I would take the first flight out in the morning, I'd come back the last flight of the evening. There are times I'd come back and my parking was more expensive than my actual round trip flight from Dallas to. Yeah, it worked out really well, and now it's just more on autopilot. You know, I use professional management, and, you know, I go down, you know, maybe every three to six months just to check on the property and see how it's going. And obviously, I'm always knee-deep in the financials as well, just, you know, monitoring things, having discussions with the management company and all that stuff. So,
was there also some additional creative marketing strategy behind these vacancies at this 20% premium per square foot in rent, Mark? Was there some other thing besides just the unit that you guys implemented or the property management company implemented that maybe other people could also implement in their portfolios to get additional rents?
Yeah, you know what? I wish I could say that there was something just mind-boggling or really special that, you know, I had done around the marketing. I think what was nice about this particular property is it literally backs right up to K-12 private charter school. And it turns out, and I didn't even realize this until I was going through due diligence on the property, but it turns out that this charter school, anybody that lives within a certain radius of the school gets free tuition to attend there. So there's a lot of people that literally want to come live in my apartment community.
Wow.
Because they get free tuition for their kids at this private charter school. So that's been huge. And aside from that too, it's just a nice area. It's a good area of Dallas. A lot of the traffic that we get is drive-by and foot traffic. You know, I have a website for the property. You know, we do all the typical, you know, mainstream marketing things. You know, it's up on the, you know, apartments.com listings and things like that. But the truth is, most of our traffic for the marketing is drive-by and walk-in. So keeping the occupancy high at this property has never been a problem. In fact, and this will blow your mind, this rarely ever happens, but during the renovation, occupancy never dropped below 94%. And that's a combination of just showing you just how great of an area it is. But at the same time, we were turning units incredibly fast. So there was some process behind that where as soon as a unit vacated, we had the teams lined up, you know, getting in there, doing the renovation. It took about 5 to 7 days to turn each unit. So we had that
wow,
down to a science, getting in there and turning all of those units. And that played a huge role. But typically, you know, I assume that occupancy is going to drop down to at least 85% during the renovation. But this was just an outstanding situation, you know, an extraordinary situation, it just didn't drop below 94.
So I did a quick calculation, $5,000 a unit, $320,000 renovation budget. Was that somehow worked into the agency loan, or is that money that you put in via cash, or did you raise money from investors for that? What was the structure of the financing, if any?
So the financing, you're correct, it was a loan-to-cost situation. Loan-to-cost is where the lender will give you the lend based on the acquisition price of the property as well as the renovation. So I was able to do up to $5,000 per unit in renovation. So this one worked out really well, and I was able to roll that into the loan. So that was really advantageous because from a cash flow perspective, you know, the property still produced cash flow, but, you know, the majority of the CapEx investments came from the loan as opposed to the cash flow. Now, I will say, too, that the cash flow of the property was really strong. So that was that, as well as coming in under budget and on a number of CapEx items. You know, I was able to renovate more than, you know, 50% of the units, you know, and I was able to fund some of that as well through cash flow as well. It really did, you know, exceed all expectations in the first year. I've been really pleased with this investment so far. That's why I love multifamily, but finding these types of deals is you know, to be honest and frank, it's much, much harder right now. So we'll see what happens with the market. But in the meantime, I'm sticking to my acquisition criteria.
So if we had some listeners right now who a lot of investors start off in single family, start off with rental properties, and then work their way up, or certainly have aspirations to get to the 20-plus unit multifamily deals. And we hear these same stories over and over from people who found success in that area, just like you, where that economy of scale works in your favor and these things become investments that their owners quite fully love. Is there anything that those listeners could do to kind of get themselves ready or start to keep that as their target on the horizon, Mark, and suggestions you can make as far as that process?
Yeah, you know, definitely. There's really three pillars that if you aspire to do, you know, larger apartment deals or any type of commercial deals, you know, in the future, there's really three pillars that you kind of need to, you know, have in the back of your mind, be aware of, and be building. These are the three things that a lender is going to care a lot about. When it comes to doing larger commercial deals or apartment deals like this, the lender's going to look to the property for the debt service. They want to make sure that property is going to produce enough income to pay for the loan. Now, that's very different than residential. In residential, the bank is actually going to look to you to provide the debt service. That's what they're going to use to underwrite it. But the commercial lender does care about three things as it relates to you. They want your net worth to be equal to or greater than the loan amount. Secondly, they want you to have enough post-close liquidity to make 12 mortgage payments, assuming that the property's income is zero. So in other words, you need to have enough cash in the bank after closing to make 12 mortgage payments, assuming that your property is vacant on day one. And the third thing is, and I swear up and down it's the most important thing, it's not official, I haven't ever seen, and it might vary by lender, but I swear up and down, this third thing is the most important. It's your experience. They want to see that you have experience owning other similar deals and that you've successfully operated that property. So for me, having owned a 12-unit apartment complex beforehand and successfully owning that property and operating it and stuff played a really important role in my experience. Again, you know, it's just, like I said, my journey's been a lot of starting with smaller deals and just gradually working my way up. Now, there's ways you can, you know, you can accelerate this. If you want to jump into multifamily sooner, a way to accelerate it is to attach yourself to a sponsor. And a sponsor is someone that does have the net worth, the liquidity, and the experience, and you can piggyback on them to do a larger multifamily deal. That is something, if that's something you aspire to do and you want to do it faster than I did, I mean, it took me essentially, 4 or 5 years to get there, you know, but if you want to do it faster, go out and if you can find a sponsor, you know, someone that's willing to allow you to attach yourself to them, then that's a way of doing it more quickly.
So, Mark, is there any simple idea, system, or strategy which you've implemented over the last 12, 24 months and experienced exponential growth or certainly notable results in your business?
Yeah, you know, as far as acquisitions and stuff like that, well, in terms of overall, you know, I just say I'm a systems guy. I look for systems. And even when I'm choosing a property management company, I look to that to understand what systems that property management company has in place too. For example, what systems or process do they have for marketing a property and qualifying potential new residents? And, you know, what happens when someone doesn't pay their rent? What is the system or the process for dealing with that situation? Same thing with acquisition. You know, I have an underwriting criteria or an acquisition criteria that any property that I look at making an offer on has to pass that litmus test, you know, of going through my underwriting process before I, you know, move forward on it. So, you know, I'm a huge systems guy, and I just say once you find your formula, your unique formula for success, you have to stick to it. Because if you can just repeat that, you can continue to perfect that system. If you can just make it repeatable, then you have infinite possibilities in essentially your earning potential. So the same thing goes for when you acquire a property, you know, and like I said earlier, my objectives are clear once I acquire a property. I need to increase the income and decrease the expenses. By doing that, I'm going to increase the net operating income. Net operating income is what determines the value of any commercial investment, right? Because that's how those types of properties are valued. It's based on the net operating income. So, you know, you asked if I have any secrets or something like that to share. I do. And I actually would love to give it away as a free gift to the listeners as a way of saying thank you for listening to me ramble for, you know, 45 minutes to an hour. Anybody that is interested, I've written a guide. It's called 10 Not So Obvious Ways to Boost Your Multifamily Property NOI. And you can get that by going to a landing page on my website. That's www.luxmana.com/REI diamonds. And you can get that paper. And like I said, that reveals some of my secrets and some of the things that I do when I acquire a property to increase the income, decrease the expenses, and drive the value of that property.
Cool. We'll make sure to add that in the show notes as well, that URL. So, Mark, who is the most successful real estate investor or developer, and why do you believe they're successful?
You know, I don't want to get political or anything, but I'm going to use Donald Trump as the example. You know, I think Donald Trump is a guy that obviously has built a brand, you know, around himself as a developer and as a real estate investor. You know, he's, you know, well known for doing extremely large deals, you know, and that certainly comes as a result of finding a system or a way of doing things and just repeating it over and over again. And I think he's obviously done a very good job of that. And he's built a brand along the way. And there's even other developers that want to attach themselves to that brand. They'll pay him like royalties and fees just to brand something as Trump because of the quality that he's known to produce. So I think he's, in my mind, you know, one of the most successful real estate investors and developers I can certainly think of.
And can you give us two or three book recommendations that you've made most often, Mark?
Yeah, you know what? I'd say we talked about it earlier. If you haven't picked up a copy of Rich Dad Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki, now's a great time to do it. They just released the 20-year anniversary edition. I mean, it's crazy to think that book came out in 1997. It's still very relevant today, but I know they've updated it and they've released a 20-year anniversary edition. I know you can get it off of the richdad.com website. I think you can even get it with like a little study guide and stuff like that as well that they offer with it. That's a fantastic book. Whether you want to do real estate or whether you just are an aspiring entrepreneur, it's going to change the way you think about money. It really was life-changing for me, you know, back when I read that book in 2003. There's also another book that I'm actually just picked up yesterday. I haven't read it yet, but it's called Wealth Can't Wait. It's by David Osborne. I'm really looking forward to reading this. You know, I know David. He's, you know, a very successful investor, and you know, I'm looking forward to reading that book as well.
If you could pair the crown jewel of wisdom, Mark, with your 18-year-old self, what would that be?
Well, I would say never stop learning. Learning leads to action, and action leads to success. You know, I think so many of us, we get the learning part down. You know, we listen to podcasts like this one. We go out, we read books like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and things like that. But then we never take any action. And we never take action for many reasons, right? Maybe we're afraid. You know, we're scared. We have fear of failure or losing money and things like that. you know, something that I would encourage anyone, and including my 18-year-old self, is, you know, there's action that you can, or baby steps that you can start to take that don't cost any money, you know, and are very, very, very low risk. For example, you can start analyzing deals. You can go out on the internet today, look at property listings, and you can start analyzing deals. As you analyze those deals, you're going to ask questions along the way. What would it cost to insure this property? So you're going to call and you're going to talk to an insurance agent. What would it cost to, you know, have professional management? Or you're going to call and you're going to talk to a property manager. And that's going to lead to discussions about, well, what are the best areas to invest? What are the features or the amenities that are going to get me the highest rent, that are going to have the shortest marketing times, and, you know, things like that? You're going to start to take baby steps that are going to lead to, you know, more and more learning. Well, when the right deal does come along, you're going to know exactly what it looks like, and you're going to be poised and ready to take action on that deal. So learning, never stop learning. Learning leads to action, and action, and only action, is what leads to success. If you sit by and do nothing, you will never be successful. So that's what I'd tell my 18-year-old self.
Yeah, and what a great example, too. I mean, I'm 10, 11 years myself in the business since 2006, and have been family residential, and have been analyzing deals ever since. In just the past year or so, I've gotten very, very fast. Pay attention to like many little indicators of value in a market that I can tell like instantaneously now. It feels like finally in the Matrix, you know, when Neo sees everything and becomes like the, I feel like my ability to look at comps and analyze specific deals in my business throughout the country has gotten to that level just in the past year. But even a few years back, I can recall how challenging it was and feeling blind when I started looking at deals originally. You know, multifamily has a different set of circumstances and can definitely be a challenge, but what a great way to baby steps, and then, you know, you start to recognize the deal when it comes through. Because early on, you know, I would see a good deal and I might have accidentally contracted it at like one of the right number and made some money on it, but like I didn't necessarily know how great the opportunity was. It was like a surprise. Wow, I got a buyer and I actually made some money here, you know? That's great. Now, you right. know, when I see that right deal, I jump right on it. Oh, this is great. I understand. Here's the reason why the lack of inventory in the days on market are so great here. This is an A neighborhood, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have
Absolutely.
Any other contact information or anything you'd like to share with the listeners if they want to use more info, Mark?
Yeah, no, you can find me at luxmana.com. And like I said, /REI Diamonds is where I have that free guide. But hey, this has been great, Dan. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on your show. And thanks for sharing so openly with so many of your listeners. You're helping a lot of people, no doubt.
Absolutely. Hey, and thank you for coming on the show, Mark. Really appreciate you closing the door, blocking out the distractions. I'm sure even though you could sleep all day, that you wake up and you probably hustle just as hard as Elvis. And me and the listeners definitely appreciate you taking time out of the day to share with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving an email notification when I release the next episode? You can either sign up at www.reidiamonds.com and get a couple cool bonuses, or subscribe through one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you are interested in either buying a deal from me or selling me a deal in one of the markets where I operate, you can visit www.reidiamonds.com and click link at the top of the page. I am currently looking for deals in the Philadelphia tri-state area, Baltimore, Maryland, D.C. market, the Chicagoland region, the Atlanta region, and the Tampa Bay area in Florida. Finally, do you know anybody else who might also enjoy this episode? I'd appreciate the referrals, and I'm sure they would too. And last but not least, I appreciate you, my loyal REI Diamond Show listener. Dan Breslin here. Peace.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.